Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Kavita Puri, and in the documentary from the BBC World Service, I hear extraordinary eyewitness accounts that tell the story, for the first time, of the Bengal famine, which happened in British India in the middle of the Second World War. The series is called 3 Million. That's the number of people who died. And there isn't a museum, a memorial, or even a plaque. How can the memory of 3 million people just disappear? Search for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
We lost our humanity. We lost our dignity. We got punished for something we did not do.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells the story of the Black 14.
Our young lives were flipped upside down.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 1400 hours GMT on Friday the 23rd of February, these are our main stories. New Western sanctions are to be imposed on Russia. Firefighters in the Spanish city of Valencia are trying to access an apartment block gutted by fire to search for people who are still missing. We get the details on proposals for the governance of Gaza after the conflict ends. Also in this podcast, in Kenya, the funeral for the marathon world record holder Kelvin Kiptum has been taking place. Plus, 2 years on from Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we ask a man who fought from the beginning if Ukraine can still win the war.
Yes, of course. I hope. But I think it's war. Will be long.
And for Oleg today, a wheelchair, medals and retirement.
Ever since Moscow launched its invasion of Ukraine 2 years ago, the West has been waging an economic conflict on Russia. Now, they're tightening the screw. The US and EU have both announced a new round of sanctions a week after the death in custody of the Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. Our Europe editor, Danny Eberhard, told us more.
The US is introducing 500 new sanctions. President Biden said that they're there to ensure that President Putin pays an even steeper price, as he put it, for his aggression abroad and his repression at home. So it's partly linked to the ongoing war of conquest, as the US calls it, in Ukraine, but also the recent death in Russian custody of Alexei Navalny, the main critic of President Putin. And what they do basically, they try to target things like Russia's defense industry, its financial sector, and people involved in repression. So there's and the EU basically is following with similar things. So the EU is listing 200 new entities, that's individuals and companies, and that brings to 2,000 the number of people that the number of the entities that the EU has listed, which is a similar figure to Britain. Britain introduced new sanctions on Thursday. So it's a coordinated campaign, this, designed to restrict revenues and cut off Russia's war machine.
But Russia has managed to get round sanctions before, hasn't it?
It certainly has. The big game here is how well it does it this time round. It's basically a game of cat and mouse or whack-a-mole. So as soon as the EU brings in sanctions, or the US, Western allies, then Russia tries to evade it. They set up networks to create parallel imports of goods through countries such as neighbouring former Soviet countries, states like Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Belarus, of course. And sometimes what happens is that individuals doing this, sometimes it's with the connivance of the authorities, or the authorities at least turn a blind eye. So it's very difficult to prosecute. There are some prosecutions, both of companies abroad and companies within, for example, the EU or the US, but they're rare. And how effective it is not quite clear. So Russia at the moment will still try to evade these things as fast as they're put in place.
Danny Eberhard. And we'll have more from Ukraine later in this edition of the podcast. A massive fire that's ripped through two apartment blocks in the Spanish town of Valencia has now been extinguished. But at least four people are known to have died, and it's feared that number will rise. Up to 15 others are still missing. Although the building is still very hot, firefighters have been able to enter the lower floors and to begin searching for missing people. There have been suggestions that the material covering the building was highly inflammable. Paco Pollet is a journalist in the city.
It's officially the worst fire suffered in the city of Valencia, I would say, ever. You know, the way it just happened, the way the fire kickstarted, that it you know, expanded and suddenly engulfed the whole building. Many questions are being aroused in the last few hours regarding the security of the construction materials, the whole polyethylene being used in the facade. You know, many questions, as I said, but yeah, definitely the whole city is in shock at this moment.
Valencia has declared 3 days of official mourning. Vincent McAvinney has this report.
Firefighters in Valencia were first alerted at around 5:30 yesterday afternoon after a blaze broke out on one of the building's lower floors. It quickly spread, with eyewitnesses saying it engulfed the entire 14-storey structure in a matter of minutes. Residents fled to their balconies, with firefighters making dramatic rescues. Others waited in the smoke for their turn.
It's shocking. I don't know what to make of it. It's sad, very sad.
I told my daughter and mother-in-law to leave. Other people stayed inside.
The residential block in Valencia's Campanar neighbourhood contains 138 flats, thought to be home to around 450 residents. More than 20 fire crews continued to tackle the blaze through the night as strong winds fanned the flames, helping them to spread to an adjoining building. There are fears for those who may have been trapped inside. A makeshift hospital was set up nearby to treat the injured. Local authorities have set up a helpline to assist those searching for loved ones who lived in the apartments. One expert who previously inspected the building has told the Spanish press the block's exterior featured a polyurethane material, which is no longer in wide use because of fears over flammability. With the speed of the fire's spread, questions are now being asked in Spain, not just about how this fire started, but about how quickly the materials used in the building's construction allowed it to take hold.
Vincent McAvinney. A report by the UN Human Rights Office has laid bare horrific violations being committed by both sides in Sudan. The report covers the first 8 months of the war there. Here's Imogen Folks.
The UN report details the most atrocious violations. This week, video emerged in which students were beheaded by men in uniform. They were later seen parading the decapitated heads through the streets, chanting ethnic slurs. The report also details rape, including of children, but says the stigma around sexual violence means few victims will report it. Satellite imagery shows widespread use of heavy explosives on densely populated areas, killing large numbers of civilians. And in Darfur, the report suggests thousands have died in ethnically motivated attacks.
Imogen Folks. Saturday marks 2 years since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which has led to tens of thousands of deaths and drawn in other countries. The BBC's Andrew Harding has reported on the war throughout. But in this report from the front lines of eastern Ukraine, he assesses the impact of the conflict through the eyes and experience of one Ukrainian fighter.
It was April 2022 in a besieged Ukrainian town called Lysychansk that we first ran into Oleg Kravchenko.
This place is an evacuation point.
Oleg, a burly, cheerful 48-year-old surgeon, had just joined Ukraine's army as a volunteer medic. He offered to drive us to a field hospital, casualties arriving from the nearby front lines.
Yes, every day it's a blood, 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 blood.
In those early days, Oleg was full of hope, of confidence.
It's my country.
But the Russians are pushing now. They're bombing a lot.
I hope maybe 1.5 months
and we will shoot every Russian.
You'll push them out?
Yes.
So you think you're winning this?
Yes, yes.
But within weeks, the Russians had destroyed and captured Lysychansk. They still hold it. It would be a year before we met Oleg again.
Nice to meet you.
Good to see you too. How are you?
Not bad. I'm enjoying the silence.
His medical team from Ukraine's 57th Brigade was now working in another frontline town, Bakhmut. Lots of new casualties from Ukraine's struggling counter-offensive. Oleg looked exhausted.
I'm still alive.
You're still alive, yes.
Alive, yes.
But it's been a difficult year.
Very difficult.
As if to prove the point, incoming fire forced us to dive for cover.
You're not worried about your safety?
My fate is... I don't know.
And now, 2 years into the war, we've come to meet Oleg's team once again. As usual, they're in the thick of it, this time in Kupiansk. Ukrainian artillery firing at nearby Russian positions. But the Kremlin's forces are starting to inch forwards here, as elsewhere. But what of Oleg? We'd lost touch with him for several months, but now heard news of an attack last October. This video shows the burning ruins of the brigade's field hospital. It had been hit one night by a Russian rocket. Three medics were killed.
My friend died.
Oleg was badly injured, but survived. His leg mangled.
It's difficult. Difficult for me, and my mind is changed after that.
When we first met in Lysychansk, you were hopeful that Ukraine could win. When we met in Bakhmut, you were tired and worried, very tired. Now, how do you feel about the war? Can Ukraine win?
Yes, of course. I hope. But I think its war will be long.
A long war then. And for Oleg today, a wheelchair, medals.
Medal of Honor. It's from Zelensky.
And retirement. After 2 years that have transformed every life in this country.
Andrew Harding. Hundreds of mourners have gathered at the funeral for the marathon world record holder Kelvin Kiptum, which has been taking place in his village in western Kenya. The 24-year-old died in a car crash 2 weeks ago. The president of World Athletics, Sebastian Coe, said he believed Kiptum would have become the first man to break the two-hour barrier in an official marathon race, and he paid this tribute.
How do I remember him? I remember him as a happy, contented, focused, dedicated, an humble man. It's a huge loss to the sport, but I think on this occasion it would be remiss of me not to reflect on the grievous loss that he is to a family, to parents, to a wife, to children.
Kelvin Kiptum's wife wept during her tribute. I asked the BBC's Celestine Caroni, who's at the burial site, to tell us about the day so far.
It's been quite a sad day here. We've had the funeral of Kelvin Kiptum. Athletes were at his house early morning. They have been walking with him the final journey to his resting place. Now, it's been quite a somber atmosphere. Hundreds have come to bid farewell to a man who was really, really loved by his community. Political leaders have come, led by the president, as well as other leaders within sport. Sebastian Coe, World Athletics president, is here. And Valerie, it's been the kind of day where people are really speaking in harsh tones. And, you know, some people have spoken to speak to me and then they put their head down and they look away and they walk away. They can't even finish sentences. So it speaks to the deep emotions that are really running high here.
And of course, this is being held in his village in Kenya, isn't it?
Yes, it is being held in Chepsamo village. This is where he grew up. This is where he went to school. So a lot of people here are mourning someone they really knew and were connected to, you know, more than just the athlete. Here, he was more than an athlete, Valerie. He was a brother, he was a friend, a schoolmate. But there are people who have come from other areas, from neighboring counties. This whole region usually has a lot of athletics community. So people have come from up to 400 kilometers away to come and mourn Kelvin Kiptum here in Chepsamo village.
And when did people there see him last?
You see, Valerie, most of the athletes usually live in their home locale. So a lot of people who come from the area, especially where the funeral is happening, you know, just a few kilometers down the road from where he actually lives, most of them see him every day. In fact, I had someone tell me in the morning after when he went running, he passed by the shop and took some tomatoes to go and make food for later. So a lot of people had seen him during the day. They had talked to him on the fateful Sunday that he passed on. So a lot of people here are remembering their last moments with Kiptum. One athlete telling me he met him and, you know, and gave him some money and said, you know, have lunch today. You know, so these are the stories we are hearing here today, Valerie.
And of course, we should remember he was only 24 when he died in a car crash.
Oh, yes, he was. Very young. He was not just a young athlete, a young talented athlete, but he also had a young family. At 24, he had a wife with two children. His eldest is 7 and his youngest is 4. He was an only child in his home. His mother was telling us that she couldn't conceive after she gave birth to Kiptum. So she decided, you know, we're just going to have one child. And so she was telling us, you know, how much despair she felt. She lost hope when her son passed on, because she said, this is my only child, what am I going to do now? But she spoke too about how her grandchildren are now giving her strength to move forward. She said, I now need to live for my grandchildren, take care of them the way I would have taken care of Kiptum.
Celestine Karoni in Kenya. The United States has returned to the moon. This time, though, more than 50 years later, it's a private company that's touched down. Built by Intuitive Machines, the craft landed in the South Pole region, and the success of the mission marks a new direction for moon exploration. But while it may have been a private company behind the initiative, there were many actors involved, not least NASA. And its chief, Bill Nelson, stressed the collaborative nature of the mission.
Today is a day that shows the power and promise of NASA's commercial partnerships. Congratulations to everyone involved in this great and daring quest at Intuitive Machines, SpaceX, and right here at NASA. What a triumph! Odysseus has taken the moon. This feat is a giant leap forward for all of humanity.
Last-minute glitches meant the touchdown was even more satisfying. Our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos, was watching as the first signals from the moon reached Mission Control in Houston.
We can confirm, without a doubt, as our equipment is on the surface of the moon, and we are transmitting.
It was a big moment for the commercial exploitation of space.
What an outstanding effort. I know this was a nail-biter, and welcome to the moon.
It was a big moment, too, for the American space program in general. Intuitive Machines has broken the United States' half-century absence from the moon's surface. Odysseus is just a robot, but its planned scientific investigations make it a scout for the return of astronauts to the moon later this decade. The South Pole landing location has water ice in shadowed craters that can be used by future explorers, says NASA's Director of Planetary Science, Laurie Glaze.
We can use that ice to convert it to water, drinkable drinking water. We can extract oxygen and hydrogen for fuel and for breathing for the astronauts. So it really helps us in human exploration.
The hope is Intuitive Machines' success will mark the start of a new lunar economy in which many private companies make money buying and selling services at the moon, such as transport, telecommunications and power.
Jonathan Amos. Still to come in this podcast...
With your phantom limb that we can't see but that you can, flex your finger, rotate your wrist, rotate it the other way. And our machine learning and AI system spits out a result so that now you, whenever you think, can just move.
How AI is being used to develop a new type of prosthetic arm for amputees without the need for implants or surgery.
When you see Iran close up, you realize just how complex a political landscape it is.
The Global Story. Smart takes and fresh perspectives on one big news story.
It seems that Iran's strategy at the moment is to increase the tension in the Middle East.
Every Monday to Friday from the BBC World Service.
When Israel does agree to a ceasefire in Gaza, Iran will then worry about Israel then turning its sights towards Iran again.
The Global Story. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I'm Kavita Puri, and in the documentary from the BBC World Service, I hear extraordinary eyewitness accounts that tell the story, for the first time, of the Bengal famine, which happened in British India in the middle of the Second World War. The series is called 3 Million. That's the number of people who died. And there isn't a museum, a memorial, or even a plaque. How can the memory of 3 million people just disappear? Search for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Reports have emerged in the Israeli media about proposed administrative arrangements in Gaza after this conflict ends. According to the Times of Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has presented the plan, which includes installing new Palestinian politicians to oversee the strip, to his security cabinet. I asked our correspondent Jenny Hill in Jerusalem to tell us more about the government's plans.
It looks as though what Benjamin Netanyahu wants to do is install what is described as local officials to effectively administer the strip. These are people who don't have any affiliation to, well, what the Israelis would refer to as terrorist organisations. So I'm reading broadly anyone who doesn't have an affiliation to Hamas, for example. Difficult to say at this stage. Would they object to people who had affiliations to the Palestinian Authority? Hard to say. At the moment, we just hear local civilians. The strip would be demilitarised and Israel would, under the plans, retain operational freedom of activity within Gaza. Mr. Netanyahu has also vowed to shut down UNRWA, that's the UN agency which looks after Palestinian refugees, which Israel has accused of complicity, or accused some of its workers of complicity with the October 7th Hamas attacks. UNRWA has fired around 10 of its staff and launched an investigation into that.
And this comes, doesn't it, as an Israeli negotiating team heads to Paris to join truce talks there. What do we know about that?
Yeah, we know that these negotiations are aimed at brokering a temporary ceasefire and the release of those Israeli hostages. An Israeli delegation has, we're told, been sent to the talks. That in itself suggests that there might be something to talk about. Israel, until very recently, was pretty damning about its position within these negotiations, and in particular Hamas's position. It described that as delusional, Benjamin Netanyahu saying that, you know, as recently as the weekend. We have, in the last couple of days, heard a note of extremely cautious optimism from one minister from the war cabinet, Benny Gantz, who said that the preliminary signs were that there was a possibility of progress towards a deal. Hamas officials were meeting Egyptian officials in Cairo in the last couple of days, and the states have sent their senior Middle East envoy to the region. He was first of all in Egypt, then in Israel, holding talks with Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday. So the talks will continue today in Paris. The Qataris are there, the Egyptians are there, both of them, of course, driving forces in these talks. But, you know, they're under some pressure, and the US very keen to get some kind of deal struck before the beginning of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, which is March 10th. And that's an important deadline because that, of course, is when Israel insists, if the hostages aren't returned, it will begin its major ground offensive in the southern city of Rafah, which is currently home to well over 1 million displaced Palestinian civilians.
Jenny Hill. Well, all this comes as a senior United Nations official has been telling the BBC about the squalid conditions in Gaza itself. The UN humanitarian coordinator, Jamie McGoldrick, has just returned from Gaza and told our correspondent Paul Adams about the situation there.
It's so overcrowded. You go there, the squalid conditions that people find themselves living in, you know, the water and sanitation problems that people have, getting clean water. You know, and then kids who just milling around, who have got nothing to do, really struggling to survive. And you can just see them that they're quite emaciated in terms of, and quite drawn and quite pale. and that's as a result of poor nutrition. And then when you see the statistics in terms of the unhealthiness of the way kids have lived there, the hepatitis A, dysentery, bloody diarrhea, all those things, these are a direct result of what's happening in terms of how they're living. And the other thing for us is the fact it's much more difficult to move around because of, one, the congestion, but also because of the law and order problems. There's more and more of our goods, material getting stolen off the back of trucks.
Tell us about the security situation for the trucks carrying aid in. Has it become really dangerous?
Yeah, I mean, the drivers themselves are taking a risk every time they go there. There's always organised smuggling, organised looting that goes on there. And what they're doing is that they're stopping trucks in certain parts of the road. They know the roads that we use and the times of the days we move on. And so they're there before we get there. A lot of times there's violence involved. And I've met truck drivers who've been beaten up by broken arms, ones who've had box knives at their throats, axes thrown at them, their windscreens, their cars get shattered.
And who are they? I mean, who is it who's doing this?
It's a combination. I mean, we don't know actually who they are, but there's obviously some organised sections of that. There's obviously very, very desperate people. You can see the amount of people there who have got nothing, absolutely nothing. And they see a truck going past, they think, this is my one and only chance to feed my family. So they go for a bag of flour or a box of food or something. That's the only way they can survive.
You went to Almawasi, I think. That's the area on the coast that the Israelis have been telling people for months to go to as a safe area. What were the conditions like there?
Well, there's about 250,000 people displaced there, and there are people still coming because they're moving away from Rafah, fearing the incursion that might take place there. And to think there's space there for more people to move in, I don't think it's true. I mean, I go there, and I've been there four or five times over the last few weeks, and every time you go there, more and more space is taken up by makeshift shelters and tented camps. There may be some areas closer to the water, but that's going to be freezing, it's going to be exposed, and it's not somewhere people want to go to. So I would say, to say that a massive number of people can be accommodated in Almawasi these days, I think is wrong.
And if not there, where?
Well, there are some areas further up from that, Derabali, you know, closer to the coast that way, and then maybe there's places there I haven't gone to, but maybe that's where people would end up going. But we also got to remember, people going back to where they came from, or people going back to these areas, there's been a lot of hostility and a lot of unexploded ordnance, and there's a real worry that people might go back there to broken buildings or go back to their houses again, which have been shelled, and there's unexploded ordnance inside, so it's a real danger.
The UN's Jamie McGoldrick. We have seen big advances in assistive technology for disabled people over the years, but with more AI being used, a revolutionary new type of prosthetic arm for amputees is closing the gap between body and bionics without the need for implants or surgery. BBC Click's Paul Carter, who was born without lower arms or legs, has been to California for an exclusive first look at a robotic arm, hoping to change the way that prosthetics are used.
When I reach in, I grab something, and I'm getting some vibrational feedback here. So that's my indicator that I know that the hand is not going to automatically open and drop whatever I'm holding. And so I don't have to sit here and watch the baseball right here in my hand because I know it's got a good grip.
Jason lost his left arm in an industrial accident in 2012. He's showing me how this prototype of a bionic arm works. It looks like a robotic human arm, just with a lot more wires coming out of it at present.
You're controlling this right now. You're moving this essentially by thinking about it. What's the process that you're going through?
I'm still thinking about the motions, and I have a phantom limb. It still feels like I'm just moving my regular hand.
Yeah.
It's a little bit more difficult, obviously, but over time and just with practice, I think it's just become easier over the years.
I was born without lower arms and legs, and so have been around and a user of many different types and shapes of prosthetics all my life. While I'm not an amputee, I'm told I'll be able to try a virtual version which works for me. It doesn't require any surgery or custom-made sockets to attach the arm.
The most advanced state-of-the-art prosthetics we control today is what you call myoelectric control. So that's putting electrodes on your stump or residual limb.
Tyler Hayes is the CEO of Atom Limbs, the company behind this technology.
When you first put the arm on, you take about 5 minutes and you train it up. And what that looks like is we say, all right, with your phantom limb that we can't see but that you can, flex your finger, rotate your wrist, rotate it the other way. And our machine learning and AI system spits out a result so that now you, whenever you think, can just move. So there's nothing in your head, nothing on your head, nothing in your arm. It's all this surface electrode and AI that basically powers it.
I was able to try a version of the tech by strapping some electrodes to my arm, which ends just below the elbow, and hooking it up to a 3D image of the prosthetic on a screen. After a few minutes of training, I was able to move the virtual arm.
This is phenomenal.
experience. This is one of the most incredible things I've ever done.
I was bending the arm at the elbow, turning the wrist, and opening and closing the hand. I've actively avoided upper arm prosthetics for most of my adult life, so this was the first time I've tried a bionic arm, and it was pretty mind-bending. The company is currently gathering data ahead of regulatory filings in the US. Exactly how much these arms would be is yet to be confirmed, though they claim the goal is to make them around the same price as other arms in the US, approximately $20,000. And rivals such as Ottobock and Ossa may mean that companies compete on price. But the hope is that prosthetics in the future will be more affordable, more versatile, and more intelligent.
That was absolutely amazing. That's the best workout I've ever had.
Paul Carter. Divorce rates have been declining in the European Union since 2006, and it's a similar picture in the US. Here in the UK, the latest figures show that divorce rates are at their lowest level for 50 years. Graeme Satchell told us more.
Divorce rates in England and Wales are down, not just a bit, but a lot. 29.5%, so almost a third in 2022. And it has absolutely baffled legal experts because they thought actually divorce rates would start to go up. Why? Because there was a new piece of legislation which came in 2022, which was meant to make divorces easier. It got rid of the so-called finger-pointing blame game around separation. So given that divorces were meant to be getting easier, why are the numbers down so much? Well, it may be partly because in that same piece of legislation, there was introduced a so-called cooling off period, which means it might take a bit longer for divorces to go through. So some of the numbers may be bumped into the next year. But actually, what most experts say is that this is all down to the cost of living crisis, that people just can't afford to get divorced. The contemplation of having to run, for example, two houses is just too much. And if you look at the figures going back to the 1950s, this is really interesting. So divorce rates went up and up and up, peaking in 1993. Since then, they've kind of gone up and down depending on what the economy's doing. So if there's a recession, people stay together. And if the economy's booming, they get divorced. It's nothing to do with romance. It's all to do with money.
Graeme Satchell on divorce, or indeed the lack of it. And that's it from us for now. But before we go, here's Jackie with news of the next Happy Pot.
In this week's edition, hurtling into history, we'll hear from Africa's first bobsleigh champion, the Spanish football club doing its bit to make the beautiful game greener, the foxes saved from a fur farm and now providing therapy in the Florida Keys, the orangutans whose communication skills include a technique we thought was unique to humans. We'll be celebrating World Gaelic Week, and the viral social media post that wasn't quite what it seemed. All in the Happy Pod from Saturday, the 24th of February.
Thanks, Jackie. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Alicia Thursting. The producer was Stephanie Tillotson. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
I'm Kavita Puri, and in the documentary from the BBC World Service, I hear extraordinary eyewitness accounts that tell the story, for the first time, of the Bengal famine, which happened in British India in the middle of the Second World War. The series is called 3 Million. That's the number of people who died. And there isn't a museum, a memorial, or even a plaque. How can the memory of 3 million people just disappear? Search for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.